Hello, and welcome to another special lockdown episode of Material Matters with me, Grant Gibson. As regular listeners will know, the idea behind the show is that I speak to a designer, maker, artist, or architect about a material or technique with which they're intrinsically linked and discover how it changed their lives and careers. Usually, we do this by visiting the guest's workshop or studio, but for the time being, we're making do by recording over the internet instead. So down the line today, I'm delighted to be joined by the artist and radical knitter, Freddie Robbins. The common perception of knitting is that it's a gentle, mindful activity, something perhaps you do quietly in front of the television after a hard day to relax. Well, Robbins' work is the antithesis of all that. It's frequently dark and always provocative. Her subject matter encompasses death, loss, religion, depression, and challenges the perceived hierarchy of the art and craft worlds. It's work that's meant for the gallery rather than to be worn at home, and comes with titles such as Bad Mother and I'm So Bloody Sad. At the same time, she's responsible for developing the talent of new generations of textile designers in her position as a senior tutor at the Royal College of Art. Her pieces are held in a number of public and private collections, including the V&A in London. Oh, and her home-come studio in Braintree, Essex, was featured on Channel 4's Grand Designs in 2011. Freddie, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you. You're welcome. I thought you'd never ask.
So tell me, we're not really talking about the virus on this show. It's meant to be a diversion from what is going on, the situation outside and the headlines we're seeing every day. However, we can't really avoid it. How are you coping? Do you have a corona routine?
It's fine, actually. I've got quite a lot of teaching work to do, so that kind of gives me a skeleton to build my day upon. Still trying to do studio work, and living in a rural environment, in many ways, the day isn't much different to how it normally would be. Mm. You know, the farm we live on still goes ahead. It's strangely familiar.
Oddly, I'm literally around the corner from you, shielding at the moment because I ruptured my spleen many years ago. So the irony of this is when we started talking about doing these things on the internet, we were like, well, we could go hugely international if we don't have to visit people's studios. And I've stayed in Braintree. I mean, obviously, as I was alluding to, you work in this 16th century barn in the Essex countryside, which is featured on Grand Designs. I'm intrigued why you decided to do that. I imagine it's stressful enough doing a build like that, moving out of London, moving into the countryside without TV cameras and, you know, Kevin MacLeod stroking his chin earnestly and looking worried for you.
Actually, doing the filming for Grand Designs was, for me, the best bit of the build.
Oh, really?
The build was really stressful and really intense. And then every month, the camera crew would turn up and they'd be really nice to you. And they'd tell you how wonderful you are. And they'd reassure you and they'd bring you cake and they'd take you out for lunch. And we were working with a lot of very young builders and they really loved the camera crew coming. It lightened the day. So actually, it was fantastic. And then it also meant you didn't have to document the process yourself. So someone else was documenting it for you.
Kevin MacLeod did it all for you.
He did it for us. And they did a really good job.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it looks an extraordinary place. And obviously, if people have seen the show, it's full of masses of toys and ephemera that you collect. Do you still have your display of cereal boxes in a case, I wonder?
We still have the white cereal display. Yeah, we have that. We have the kind of, for want of a better term, the interior design philosophy was based on the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford.
Right.
So the open space is divided up with glass cases full of stuff, full of, you know, the things are predominantly completely worthless, but that's how we've kind of made the space work to a certain extent.
So, I mean, for the listeners, could you describe, well, the space really, and also maybe what you collect?
Okay, so it's, like you said, it's a 16th century timber frame barn with a huge concrete floor. And then at one end, there are two concrete block built round grain silos, and they separate off the sleeping area from the living area. And we sleep and live, well, we sleep upstairs and our daughter sleeps downstairs, and we have a spiral staircase in one of the round silos, and the other silos have round bathrooms with no doors, which actually is quite a problem.
I can imagine.
And then we've built a false wall, which the kitchen is against, and then we have a huge open plan studio the other side of that with an enormous library. But the living space, which has the glass cases in, the glass cases contain things like religious iconography, religious kind of collectibles, toys. We've got quite a lot of items related to the human body. We've got robots. We have got those cereal collection of cereals, as you mentioned. We've got, and they're mixed up. So some of the things are bought, some are found. And also we've got quite a lot of artworks by friends and also by ex-students kind of in with the mix.
Right.
And we tried to put everything under glass because the barn is constantly shedding. It's like constantly, there's just dust all the time, just dripping out of the timbers, although I did go and hoover every single one of them.
Hang on, you hoovered timbers?
Yes.
Wow.
At the end of the build, I had to go up in a cherry picker and try and hoover off every single beam because it was just filthy. The space really dominates us.
Yeah.
She's very needy. I spend a lot of time in lockdown cleaning her.
And she's alive by the sound of the way you're talking about her.
She is alive. I think that's one of the really interesting things about converting a building that is many centuries older than you. The building dominates and it doesn't really care who lives in it or who, because it's been here for much longer than you and it will be here much longer than you will. So that's, you're just taking care of it. It does completely dominate how you do the build, but also how you live. I quite like that. You don't get to do everything your way. You get to do it the building's way.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, did it change your work moving to a different space with the kind of scale that you're obviously living in?
Well, it's interesting because when we were doing the build, I presumed that I would make much, much larger work, having much larger space. But actually, it's made me want to make much smaller work. you're really changed by the process of building, but you're also changed by the time.
Right.
It was the best part of 2 years, and you're a different person after 2 years anyway. So, yeah, interesting. When we first completed the build, I was using quite a lot of materials that were around us on the yard. I was using quite a lot of wood in my work, but actually I've gone completely against that now. And I just want to use fiber and just use textiles and just be true to the kind of unstable but nature of textiles.
Right, right. Because the other thing that you've done whilst you've been in Essex and with your partner, Ben, who's also an artist, is you've set up this new collective, Blackwater Polytechnic.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the Blackwater Polytechnic, it's not a polytechnic, obviously, because sadly, polytechnics no longer exist. Mm. But what we were wanting to do was really to embrace the spirit of making and skill. And so that's what the polytechnic's about. So I really enjoy the way that you can kind of subvert things, as you can tell from my work. So the Blackwater Polytechnic is the subversion of an educational environment. So when we were building, our builders were at the Polytechnic, but they all had full grants. They were all, you know, they were on a wage. So everyone that comes through gets paid. And we also obviously met a lot of local creative individuals and they've become involved. So we do exhibitions at the barn, open studios, but we've also taken groups of artists to America, to New York, to Berlin.
Oh, wow.
And last year we had a small show in Odense in Denmark with another artist collective. Mm. So that's been a really fantastic thing that would I don't think would happen in London. London's too big and there's too many other opportunities. And once you move out of London, you have to work much, much harder to make your own opportunities. And so that's what the Polytechnic enables us to do. And it also enables us to be independent. I really love the way that it's unfunded. We just fund it ourselves, do what we want to do.
You've shown abroad, but do you have shows in the UK, in Essex, presumably?
Well, we show within the barn, but we also had a show at the Minories in Colchester.
Right, right.
The year before last. So we show when we feel like it. Again, it's everything's on our terms, which really suits the way Ben and I like to be. Mm. We don't really like to be beholden.
Mm. Mm. I have a long-standing ambition to make Braintree UK City of Culture 1 year after Coventry. So maybe we should talk about that later.
I would love to do that.
Yeah, yeah. I think it would be excellent. In fact, I have a bet with the architecture critic of the Times about it. He doesn't think it will happen. I'm going to prove him wrong. Anyway, I'm digressing.
Well, we first met our architect. He didn't think our build would happen.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. He didn't think we could make it happen, but we did.
Yeah. Yeah. So can we talk about your background, Freddie? Because you come from Hitchin in Hertfordshire originally, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's talk about Hitchin, shall we? What did your parents get up to in Hitchin?
Well, we moved very swiftly to Brighton and my parents were extraordinarily ordinary. in many ways, but obviously not. But they had that kind of appearance where my mother looked after us and my father went to work in a finance company every day in his company car wearing a suit. But of course, the backstory to that is much more complex, and they were much more kind of interesting individuals. They were much older parents. So there's a kind of generation missing in our family. So that was something that I think has quite a big impact upon you. But neither of them did anything creative. In fact, my mother had been a teenager in the war, so she hated the idea of having to make anything.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah. So she just loved shopping at Marks and Spencer's for food and for clothes. She didn't want to make and make do and mend. That wasn't her thing at all.
Because it was your godmother who was kind of seems to be the pivotal person in your development.
Yeah.
What role did she play?
Well, she was my mother's childhood friend, and they always stayed close. And she made things. And in fact, she made lots of clothes for my mother. So she was a great maker. So in many ways, they were very different to each other. But I think, again, I saw my godmother lived on her own. She wasn't married. She had no children, or so I thought. And I thought she was like the epitome of the modern woman. She went to work every day. She did what she wanted. And so I always associated making with a kind of freedom, which was what I saw her as having. And I associated it with a modern independent woman who went to work, which I think isn't how most people associate. Most people don't associate knitting or making with textiles with anything kind of modern. But that was my experience. So that was my belief. And actually, I was really shocked when I discovered that wasn't true. I was really shocked when I discovered that people thought hand knitting was something kind of old fashioned.
I mean, she used to knit, obviously. Is this where you got the knitting bug from?
Yeah, she did knit, and she used to, I would show her things I liked and she would just make them for me.
Right.
And I thought that was amazing. Well, it is amazing. She could just reproduce things. And at the time, it was cheaper to reproduce clothes than to buy them in a shop. I mean, that's not true anymore. But at the time, when I was growing up in the kind of 70s, that was very true. And I would see something in a shop like Miss Selfridge, and she would go and look at it, and then she would buy fabric and make it for me.
Was there a point where you decided that you were going to make or you were going to knit your own stuff? When did that happen?
I suppose in my early teens, I started making things for myself. And I spent time with my godmother, Pam, and we would make things together and she would help me. And we did all different kind of home crafts. Yeah, that was very, very early on. And then when I was about 18, I entered a national competition, a national competition to design a jumper, a contemporary jumper.
Right.
And by some amazing miracle, I won it. I won that competition.
Right.
But to give you a little bit of insight into how my parents operated, when the letter came, my mother hid it because she didn't want me to be disappointed.
That's interesting.
Yeah, that was kind of her. I think that was not that she didn't believe in me, but I think she always tried to protect me.
Yeah.
And I think that I constantly amazed her. I don't know if always in a good way.
Well, I mean, what did your parents make of this kind of knitting habit you were developing?
I think they just thought maybe it was a good way to pass the time. When I decided I wanted to go to art school, they were, I think, again, really terrified. It seemed to them such a bizarre choice of future, and they had no understanding of what was possible. I think they were really worried for me. But equally, they didn't say I couldn't go. I mean, other parents might have said you can't go. They supported me in my endeavor. And I think they thought it paid off. For quite a long time, they did struggle to really understand what it meant. But very endearingly, when my father retired, he developed a real interest in art and in galleries. And he would go and look at a lot of exhibitions and watch a lot of television programs, I think, to try and really understand a world that he was completely unfamiliar with.
I mean, you talk about what it meant. I mean, I'm intrigued. What did knitting mean to you? What did you find, and what do you find still so intriguing about wool and knitting?
I think originally it was this kind of mix between working things out mathematically and then kind of converting that into a three-dimensional object. although at the time I couldn't articulate that, I think I was always really fascinated by the fact that you could write a pattern in this language that people that don't knit can't understand, and then that pattern could be translated through your hands into something else. And I used to really love that process of writing and working it out and then making. To be honest, as I've got older, I've got more frustrated with that process, because knitting is, it needs such a lot of preparation.
Right.
At times I just want to make stuff and I want to go through that. So I have different bodies of work that I do depending on my kind of state of mind. But I really, really like working with my hands. I really love holding materials. I love them passing through my fingers. I love conducting materials. And when you're working with yarn, you're working with colour. And that's not true of all creative disciplines. You can spend your time with a colour you really love as opposed to applying the colour afterwards. Mm. And of course, you can undo it. The work can be unravelled. So you can undo it and start again. You can go off in any direction. It's the most amazing process. It's witchcraft.
Mm. Well, you've described it as the right balance of order and freedom for you,
yeah,
which I rather like.
Yes, no, definitely.
The order one can understand, the freedom I'm intrigued by.
Well, I like the way you can change your mind with it. In life, you can't always change your mind. And in making, you can't always change your mind. But with knitting, you can.
Mm.
Like I said, you can unravel it, but you can also do magical things like cast off lots of stitches or knit off in another direction. You're completely free to go wherever you want with it.
Mm. Mm.
And I think that one thing I know about myself is I like the possibility of freedom, even if I don't want to take advantage of it.
Right.
I mean, maybe a good illustration of that is I hate it when the shop's shut. I might not want to go to them, but what happens if I do? I like things being available for me when I want them.
Mm. You must enjoy being in the countryside in that case.
No. It's funny. I struggle with the countryside. It's so beautiful. And then I just go, so what? But, and I have really struggled with living here. But actually during lockdown, it's the best place to be. Because yeah. if I was still living in London, I would be so frustrated that everything was shut and I couldn't go to it.
Mm. Mm.
There's not much to go to here anyway, so that's kind of okay.
Yeah. I mean, were you good at school? Was art school always going to be where you were going to end up, or did you have choices, I wonder?
I was good at school. I was quite an academic child. My best subject when I was a child was mathematics, and I think I thought I would end up doing something like my dad, something to do with numbers, but it became increasingly kind of uninteresting for me. And
right.
I think I wanted to find a life or create a life that was more unusual. Yeah, I didn't want a life like other people. And that sounds really awful because I really like people, but I didn't want to live like them.
Well, it's interesting because on that Grand Designs show, you described yourself as awkward, difficult and demanding. Is that true?
Yes, but that is, yes. Yeah, I think I'm very demanding of myself, and possibly I'm demanding of people close to me. Am I difficult? I guess so, but what's the benefit of being easy? Particularly as a woman, you know, it's like everything's stacked against you, so kick back. I mean, my dad always used to say, why be so difficult when with a bit more effort you could be bloody awful? Or bloody impossible, actually. Yeah, he used to say, why be difficult when a little more effort you could be bloody impossible? I think those things are fine, aren't they? Otherwise, you just get completely ridden over by mediocrity and the way the world wants you to be, by conformity, which I really loathe. And I think that if Ben and I hadn't been awkward and difficult, and demanding, we would never have done this build. We wouldn't both be artists.
Mm.
We'd be something else. And so I think it's okay to be difficult. It's fine. It just is.
Good. So you studied constructed textiles at Middlesbrough Polytechnic and then went on directly to the Royal College of Art.
Yeah.
On leaving, and I didn't know this, you co-founded a practice called Tate & Style with Ingrid Tate,
yeah,
designing fashion and furnishing accessories for 8 years. You had collections sold in the Conran shop and at Harvey Nichols, and you sold in the US and Japan, as well as producing pieces,
yep,
for the likes of Paul Smith and Comme des Garçons, Galliano. I mean, it sounds like you were doing pretty well. So was there a point when you've decided you've had enough of this and I want to make art instead?
I think there were so many fantastic things about doing that company with Ingrid. Amazing things. Like we did the first 100% design show.
Oh, did you?
I mean, amazing. Yeah, but I became increasingly frustrated with the fact that the concept behind the work was never that interesting to the client. It became all about price, and particularly in the fashion world, it became all about the right color for the right season. I hated the timetable where you were on this kind of treadmill of always having to show at the same time of year. The buying was always done at the same time of year. I just didn't like the repetition of it. Mm. And I wanted to investigate other things. I loved the theory of the business. I loved the theory of how you could structure that and how you can make that work. But I didn't like applying it to my own creativity. It just came to a natural end for me.
Was it immediately obvious what kind of art you were going to make?
No. I knew I wanted to return to knitting because when I'd been working with Ingrid, we weren't doing so much. And I knew I wanted to work with that. I didn't really know how to do that. I was kind of looking around for other artists and other makers, and I was very inspired by Caroline Broadhead and the way I could see her working with different materials to create objects that sat somewhere between kind of function and concept. Mm. And I started making this series of gloves, which was called a series of odd gloves, playing with the form of a hand and the function of gloves. And I exhibited them in Ben, who's my now husband, his open studio exhibition. People responded to them really well. Mm. And I was kind of amazed. And so that gave me the real confidence to push forward. And then I applied to the Craft Council for what at the time is called a setting up award.
Right.
I felt sure they wouldn't give it to me because this was quite a long time after graduating. And in fact, people who I'd been studying with at the Royal College, like Ma Rana, was on the panel, and I really felt they would just say, come on, you should have sorted this out by now. We can't support you. Get on with it. And they supported me. And that was, you know, that was so fantastic, again, to have someone else believing in you and promoting you. Mm. And then it just, things just took off very, very swiftly after that. And I had quite a lot of commissions to do. I had lots of exhibition opportunities. And that, you know, that was the start of it, really.
I mean, it can be, as we described in the opening, it can be quite dark, your work.
Yes.
There's a quote on your website about a collection you did called Out on a Limb, which I think was probably, you showed at Collect.
Yes.
The Crafts Council's high-end art fair at the Saatchi Gallery. And you described the collection in a series of words, which goes like this, which is samples and surpluses, things donated and inherited and found, domestic craft, mass manufacture, exquisite craftsmanship, embellished and encrusted, excess, needless, disembodied, immense violence, fear, loss, death, pain, pins and needles, and wool. I mean, this is a long way from a Café Facet jumper, right?
Yes, it is. The dark side. I think it's that thing of facing your fears, facing up to the things that are the most terrifying. I think that's always been something that I have wanted to do, although it is quite terrifying. There's enough work that kind of investigates beauty. There's enough optimistic work. I don't need to join those ranks. I suppose I also think that knitting or textile crafts deserve a broader kind of subject matter. So often they are associated with things to do with nurture and care, something to do with pleasure, something to do with love, whereas other disciplines seem to be allowed a much broader scope. And I'm always pushing against the rules or the perceived rules. I'm always looking for ways to subvert things. And so that just was the way, that just felt the, you know, like the way I wanted to work. It's not that I'm trying to be shocking. If I really wanted to shock, I could do much more than that. It's more about an investigation I'm interested in, and then it transpires other people are interested too.
Well, let's take the series of tea cozies that resembled houses that were lived in by five different female murderers.
Yeah.
Where did the idea for that spring from?
That was an idea that came around a growing awareness of enormous gender inequality. and where a man commits a heinous crime, he's damned. And when a woman commits a heinous crime, she's doubly damned because she's committed a crime, but she's dared to go against what she's meant to be as a woman. And that was the real starting point, the kind of daring not to be what society deems you should be. And so for me, the use of knitting to explore that idea was absolutely perfect because it is like a quintessential domestic passive female art. And then I had got in my collection a small collection of knitted tea cozies in the shape of country cottages. Again, this was so perfect, like using a form that knitting has taken and does take, and then completely subverting that. So for me, that piece of work is kind of conceptually and process and materially perfect. I really enjoyed the research process where I found these stories and I went and photographed the properties, or I found photographs of the properties and then converted them into knitting patterns. And then I worked with a hand knitter who I would send the pattern to and the yarn and the stories, and she would make the pieces up for me.
Right.
And what I loved about it was every single time I sent her a story, she'd go, "Oh, that's awful." And then knit the pieces.
Sorry.
No, I mean, it's great. It was so great. That's the story behind that piece.
So how did you choose the five? Did they commit particularly hideous murders, or did they live in houses that would turn easily into tea cozies? What was the selection process?
I was looking at crimes where women had killed alone. They weren't killing in partnership with a man. They were killing completely alone. And that was the criteria for me. And then with a lot of the crimes, as I was doing the research, I discovered that poisoning is the woman's crime. And there's a little rhyme that goes, when poison is found, the murderer's gowned. Because women predominantly have access to food. They're doing the food preparation. They're expected to do that. They're expected to give and provide food. So it's the perfect way to get rid of someone is by putting the poison in the food you've lovingly prepared for them. So that was the kind of the way I chose the houses, but also the kind of stories that I discovered whilst I was making them. I mean, the most fantastic stories, like one of the houses that I knitted, the writer Deborah Mogach, her mother lived in it.
Oh, wow.
And somehow she found out about this piece of work and emailed me. And then we had this fantastic email conversation about her mother living in this house where this awful crime had committed. And at one point I was on Wikipedia listed kind of aligned to one of the killers in her profile. It got that I'd knitted her house.
Wow.
So what I really love is the kind of serendipitous things that happen off the back of the work I make.
Mm.
For me, these things are absolute magic. And often they're completely unknown things, but they're things that give me a huge amount of pleasure.
Mm. So I would argue that textiles is having a bit of a moment in the art world currently. You had the Annie Albers retrospective at Tate Modern last year.
Mm-hmm.
Knitting seems to become hugely fashionable. It's part of the mindfulness movement.
Yes.
It's been used as a kind of unlikely medium for protests and activism, the Pussy Hat Project, I should say. Does this make you happy? Do you think you're succeeding in your work in that case?
It does make me happy, but I think it's a trend.
Mm.
I think it's something that everyone's talking about it having a moment and then it'll not have a moment. I think there are different ways of working with textiles, and there's an increasing number of artists who've adopted textiles and use textiles, but the work they make isn't thinking through the process of making textiles. It's adopting it as you might adopt ceramics, or you might adopt any medium. And there seems to me to be an increasing number of artists who take their ideas just into lots of different mediums.
Right.
Without working through that medium, without thinking what that medium means, or also without knowing how that process operates. And I don't think that artists have to make everything by their own hands, but I think there's a huge amount of difference if you understand the process than if you don't. And I think you can always really tell and see that in the work. So I would argue that a lot of the work that we're seeing where people are saying, oh, textiles is having a moment, a lot of that is a process that's adopted, not a process that's been kind of committed to or developed or loved.
Yeah.
That isn't true of everyone, like Sheila Hicks and Annie Albers, that isn't true. But a lot of contemporary art that you see in textiles It's just using it because it's fashionable.
And is that a problem?
I don't think it makes interesting work. It's just another type of work. It's not really where I see myself aligned. And I think it's really problematic if people think, oh, it's okay because textiles is accepted now as a medium. And I think, well, it's only accepted if it's done by the right person and shown in the right place. Otherwise, it's not really accepted. And so I'm kind of quite skeptical about it.
But that's the art world all over, right? I mean, the art world is smoke and mirrors fundamentally.
Yeah. Yes, yes. And I think it's more fashionable than the fashion world. And that's okay. That's just what it is. And I guess that's why I don't necessarily align myself purely in that world. I like being between worlds. I like being between spheres of activity.
Which is a harder place to be though, Freddie, right?
Maybe harder to make a living, but not for me, it's not harder to be creative in that way because I don't like fitting in too comfortably.
Which, I mean, you're a bit of a contrarian. You don't like rules, right?
I don't like other people's rules. I've got enough of my own, thanks. I don't need other people's. I'm also slightly questioning of the way that textiles has been completely adopted by the mindfulness movement as well. I think it's wonderful if things enhance your life. But again, for me, with something like knitting becoming so closely associated with well-being, for me, then it becomes back to this thing about it being good for you. And I just get a bit sick of things being good for you. You know, why do things have to be good for you? Why can't we just do them? So I'm kind of conflicted about it, really conflicted.
I mean, let's talk more about your work, because as we've discussed, it picks up a number of themes on death, feminism, religion, and as we've just been talking about, what the notion of craft might be. I'm intrigued by a piece that you created that the magazines seem to love, which is a full-size self-portrait of you, of San Sebastian being martyred. And instead of arrows piercing your skin, there are knitting needles. And on the front of the figure, the full-size figure, it says simply, craft kills. Mm-hmm. What is that piece saying?
So that piece was me thinking about how would it be if craft wasn't seen as a benign passive activity, particularly knitting? How would it be if it was seen as something dangerous, potentially lethal? Maybe we were banned from doing it. Maybe like if it was viewed like smoking or drug taking or alcohol abuse or gun ownership, how would it be if it was viewed like that? And so that was the thinking behind the piece, like that completely looking at it from another point of view, that in another society in a parallel universe, people could say, no, you can't do craft activities. They're really, really dangerous for society.
So it's running against this well-being movement that you were just talking about, in other words.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's an older piece. It was from 2002, so it was before the well-being kind of movement really kicked in. And it was also before 9/11 that I made it. And then when I showed it in New York some years later, because of the effects of 9/11 upon New York, people viewing it saw it completely in that context, and they saw it as being something much more threatening. And also at the time, because of 9/11, knitting needles had been deemed a dangerous weapon to fly with. You weren't allowed to fly with knitting needles. And so knitting on airplanes then had become this really dangerous activity. And also, it's still true now, actually, that lots of charity shops won't have knitting needles out on the shelves. You have to ask for them. They're kind of under the counter. And so that, again, was a serendipitous thing that happened that slightly changed the meaning of the work, or kind of added to the story, which, like I said before, I love. It's a gift. It's an absolute gift having those kind of stories build on it. And then that piece of work toured in a show in America, a show called Radical Lace and Subversive Knitting, Subversive Lace and Radical Knitting, those four words paired together.
Right.
And in one of the venues, people took the knitting needles from the ground and stabbed them into the eyes and genitals of the figure.
Oh, wow. How did that make you feel?
Well, initially I just felt that they just really hadn't taken care of the work properly. But again, in retrospect, it's a good story and it makes you think about other kinds of things and why someone would do that.
Well, why would you? I mean, that's quite a disturbing image you've just stuck in my head.
Well, it's interesting because I've had my work vandalized, for want of a better word, or stolen 3 times in public exhibition. 4 times. And so is there something in this? Is there something so offensive about working with knitting that people feel the need to steal it or vandalize it or attack it or pick bits out of it? I'm utterly intrigued by the response that it can have. And again, in a subversive, perverse way, I enjoy that.
Yeah. I'm intrigued. There's another piece you did, and I think this was vandalized as well, called I'm So Bloody Sad, which I mentioned in the intro, which is a kind of a floppy, abstracted torso with incredibly long arms and an elongated head that's flopping backwards off its neck. I mean, was that describing your state of mind at the time, I'm guessing?
Yeah, I guess that's a piece about feeling completely dejected, and also just a very honest admission that I think people don't always care to make, because that's just the truth of being a human, that sometimes you're happy and sometimes you're sad and our emotional states aren't constant. And so, it really was about that. But yeah, that piece, someone drew on that piece with felt pen.
Is there a reason for them drawing or?
Well, it was in the gallery. It was placed very close to the kind of family activity area, which had the masses of felt pens. But actually, the drawing on the work was quite high up, and it's actually quite hard to draw on wool. Mm. So I really don't know. But it did make me really question, like I really enjoy public interaction in art galleries, and I think it's important that people can go and, you know, have activities within art galleries, and that art galleries aren't just these kind of cathedrals to art. But I did begin to wonder, well, what's more important here? Is the freedom of the felt pen more important than a piece of work that I spent a lot of time making? And again, initially I was really upset about it, but later on I wasn't. Mm. Later on, it was kind of okay, and the piece was restored and the felt tip marks were removed. But before that happened, I was thinking, well, maybe I should just leave the felt pen marks in it. Maybe that's just the story of that piece of work, that it just bears the scars of abuse.
Mm. Mm.
Maybe that's okay.
And when you look at a piece like that, it's obviously reflective of a moment in time, possibly. I mean, how do you feel when you look back on a piece like that, I wonder, after time? Because presumably you were very upset when you were making it, or dejected when you were making it. And I don't know whether you still go through these phases or whether you are. But I'm interested in how you feel about some of the pieces years after you've made them.
That piece, when I made it, I really struggled to come to terms with it because it's very ugly. But actually, that's a piece that I enjoy more and more. The more I see it, I've enjoyed being able to move away from maybe attractive colour. It's quite an ugly form. Yeah, that is a piece that I've enjoyed more and more over the years, definitely. Maybe other works that I'm more pleased with initially, that pleasure doesn't last. Maybe that's a more momentary thing.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I've made quite a lot of work to do with motherhood as well. And of course, your feelings about that change as your child grows and as you grow. And so some of those works, you know, I would never make them now. I think they're always a kind of point in time that relates to you as the maker, but also relates to what's happening in the society you find yourself in at that particular moment.
Mm. I mean, moving on, can we talk a little bit about your process?
Yep.
How you make things? You don't like drawing or sewing, I read.
I struggle with drawing. And when I draw, I tend to do it to make a commitment to a piece of work. I don't find it very helpful in working out how to make the piece of work. And so I think it's much more, like I said, like signing a contract with myself that this is something I want to make.
Right.
With the making process, it really depends what state of mind I'm in, whether I want to embark upon something that's technically quite difficult and I have to spend a lot of time working it out. And I've become increasingly less interested in that. At the moment, I'm trying to work on these kind of soft collages that use bits of knitting and things cut out of magazines. And I've been doing a much more hand knitting, actually, where I've kind of worked out a pattern, but then also been quite free with what I'm doing. But then on the flip side of that, I've also been doing some work with automated digital knitting,
right,
where I have to prepare a computer file on the computer to get knitted. And actually, that is really difficult for me because I love the work I've made. I really love it, but I absolutely hate the process.
Why is that?
I don't like sitting in front of the computer for ages in Photoshop, clicking on squares. It's like completely mindless. And it makes me feel so awful physically. But it's worth it because the end piece of work that I had from this, I mean, it's a huge knitted blanket, which I call a knitted tapestry, to try and change the way people view it. Because if you say it's a blanket, people immediately assume it's functional and that its value is relatively low. But I'm really thrilled with the results of that. But that came at some level of pain. And I'm trying to, right. to work on another piece at the moment, but I just keep getting stuck with it because I don't want to sit on the computer. Particularly now we're in lockdown and you spend even more time on the computer. I don't really want to be there, but I've got to pay, you know, go through the pain barrier to get this piece of work out.
Mm. Mm. How does teaching fit into your practice? I mean, you're a senior tutor at the Royal College. What does that bring to what you do?
I mean, one thing it gives me is interaction with other people, which I really enjoy. I really enjoy sitting down with an individual or with a group of individuals and talking about ideas and talking about the meaning of ideas and talking about the meaning of creativity. I find that intensely stimulating. At times, it's very challenging. Times it's very boring. But I teach at a relatively high level. I teach MA students and some PhD students. So it's more challenging than boring at that level. I enjoy the intellectual challenge about thinking about how people learn, how you teach. I undertook a PG cert a few years ago and I found that really, really, really stimulating. In thinking about what it actually means to have an education and whether that is beneficial or not, and how you might be able to include more people in that process as opposed to it becoming quite an exclusive thing.
Mm.
It operates on lots of different levels for me, but it is. I can't imagine a time when I didn't teach.
Yeah.
I've always taught ever since I graduated from the Royal College in one way or another. And now I'm nearer the end of my, possibly nearer the end of my life than the beginning. I can't see a time when I wouldn't teach. And I must really love it because when I took the job at the Royal College, I said to myself, I wouldn't be there. I wouldn't be there for 10 years. That would be it.
Yeah.
But I've been there for nearer 20 now. So
yeah.
So it's obviously good.
I mean, are we in danger with the virus of this year group getting lost, I wonder? Because presumably they won't have a show.
They will have to have an online show. I don't think they'll get lost. I definitely don't think they'll get lost. They're graduating in a way that no one else has ever graduated before, into a world that no one's ever graduated into before. I think it would just be different, but I don't know how. I mean, one of the things that I think, I mean, I'm so materially based that I do find teaching online and the virtual show, I find that difficult. Because I'm such a material person, but not everyone is like that. And I think increasingly people don't go to shows like they used to because the work can be seen in so many different ways and there are so many shows to see. I think the virtual exhibition will reach a much, much wider audience. And I think it opens up, you know, new possibilities. But yeah, materially, it's a big challenge.
Yeah. And also, had the virus not struck, you would have been one of the 13 selectors for the Maker's Eye.
Yeah.
Which is the new installation that was going to reopen the Crafts Council's exhibition space in London.
Yeah.
And the deal with that was that each person would choose objects from the organization's collection.
Yeah.
And then they had to choose something that they felt should be in the collection.
Yeah.
You chose one of your own pieces, Freddie.
Obviously.
Is this an example of you trying to bend the rules again?
I think... my initial thoughts were I had a long list of people that I thought should be in the collection. And I thought, like I often do here, I can write something, I can make something right. And then I had this completely other thought about, well, no one's selecting me. Who's selling me? Who's choosing me? Who's putting me forward? And although I have lots of supporters, I don't have a gallery. I don't have anywhere where I can sell in a regular way or receive commissions That just doesn't exist for me. And so I just thought, well, this is ridiculous. Like, you've got to look after yourself. And so I tentatively asked, you know, could you put yourself forward? I thought they would go, no. And they went, yeah.
Good Lord.
So I thought, yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is a piece of work that I wanted to get into a public collection.
Yeah,
I've shown it so many times. It's been reproduced in books so many times. It's a piece people always refer to. And the Craft Council collection is the perfect collection to house it. And so it was a, you know, again, it was a gift that I shouldn't throw away on someone else.
Okay. I'm not sure, had I been curating the show, I would have said yes to that. But
well, thank God you weren't.
Yeah, seemingly.
You know, I'd be sitting here in my underwear because I wouldn't be able to afford to buy new clothes. Why is it more acceptable to spend money nominated by someone else that's been made by an individual than it is to spend money on work nominated by that individual if the work is of the right quality and says the right things for the collection? There's no difference in what you get. So it felt to me that that was okay. And I guess also the work had to be approved because it was bought by the art fund. So the work had to be put forward and approved, and it was approved by copious numbers of other people. So that felt okay.
Good. Okay. Well, I mean,
yeah,
I'm not at all sure about it, but you know, hey,
that's fine, Grant.
Yeah, I know.
I'm glad you're not sure about it, because wouldn't the world be boring if everyone agreed and just went, yeah, that's right?
No, I agree. I think it's interesting, Freddie. I mean, you raised some valid points. I mean, my feeling is that you're quite right. It's a valid piece that should definitely be in a collection. The Crafts Council's collection is as good as any, quite frankly, for it. Mm-hmm. It just seems politically, it feels awkward somehow.
But again, I think it's come back to this thing of, do we always have to wait to be asked by someone else? Like, do you always have to wait? And if I always waited to be asked by someone else, I would never be able to do anything, because frankly, not many people are asking. So that's another kind of, for me, that's another interesting thing about how polite are you? How much do you wait before someone asks you? And I had quite an interesting thing in America where I went to visit a gallery with an American maker friend of mine. And of course, I was hoping that they might want to do some work with me, but I never said, because I thought that was kind of implicit in my visit. But my American friend had a very different approach to it. And she immediately said, I'd like to show in this gallery. When are you going to come and visit me? When are we going to set something up? And guess who got to show in the gallery? Not the person that didn't ask. And I was super intrigued by that more direct approach to getting what you would like.
Well, this is certainly a direct approach, Freddie. No question of that. Can we talk about, it's difficult, I know, at this time, but do you have plans for the future? What can we expect from you going forward when we eventually get out of this situation that we're currently in?
Well, the Blackwater Polytechnic is showing with Craft Space in a show that will hopefully open in the autumn, but obviously it might not. And it's a show called We Are Commoners, and it's about commoning kind of activities, provisions for the common. I suppose it's perceived as the common good. And so the Blackwater Polytechnic are making a piece of work to go in that exhibition, which should open at MAC in Birmingham. Beyond that, I'm just going to keep making more work, just trying to push myself forward in different ways. I said right at the beginning that I was making work now that was kind of softer. I'm interested in kind of looking more at the hierarchy of materials, doing more about kind of promoting soft, floppy things as, you know, maybe equal value to things that are solid and hard and are permanent in their shape. So that's one of my kind of areas of interest and research at the moment. Like, who's scared of the soft stuff? Seemingly just about everybody, actually. So that's my kind of current question to myself, and exploring that in fairly obtuse, difficult, awkward, demanding ways. through knitting and fibre.
Good. Well, look, we look forward to seeing the results of these difficult explorations that you're going through. Freddie, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. I've really enjoyed it, Grant. Thank you for not being so agreeable. I like that.
And to learn more about Freddie's work, go to freddierobbins.com. There are images from the interviews as well as little films and other things on my Instagram page, Grant on Design. If you've enjoyed listening and want to see this podcast flourish, then please rate and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to this from. If you feel so inclined, you can go to my Patreon page and make a pledge at patreon.com/materialmatters. You'll be helping to take the message of the importance of materials, skill, craft and design to a whole new audience. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you're all staying safe.